Welcome back to Season 4 of Media Minded, the show that guides you through the age of disinformation. In this episode, we will dive into an increasingly alarming part of a terrorist's toolbox, technology. This podcast is produced by Shoutout UK, the leading political and media literacy education platform, and is made possible by the generous support and sponsorship of the Global Engagement Center at the US State Department. I am your host, Matteo Bergamini, founder and CEO of Shoutout UK, here to challenge your understanding of the world around you, and hopefully not your attention span. Technology is a double-edged sword. It has allowed our world to connect at lightning speeds, streamline workloads, and open the door to previously unthinkable possibilities. But in the shadows of progress, a different kind of advancement thrives. Violent extremists exploit every technological leap, weaving more convincing lies and reaching a wider audience than ever before. For every step forward that innovators take, terrorists are taking two or three. Violent extremists all over the world are wielding emerging technologies in different ways, depending on the platforms favored by their specific movement or location of their groups. The most widespread and well-known tech tool to spread extremist ideology is the internet. Social media giants like TikTok, X, formerly known as Twitter, and YouTube, with their massive youth engagement, have become breeding grounds for spreading radical views like Irish white nationalist Keith Wood or Australian nationalist Joel Davis. You might be familiar with how the far right has taken common memes and twisted them into racist or anti-Semitic symbols shared across platforms. Even established terrorist organizations like ISIS leverage the power of the internet, operating official propaganda channels alongside a network of smaller accounts that amplify their message, creating a vast online echo chamber for radicalization. Q. Anna Krenin, a research fellow for the Current and Emerging Threats Program at the International Center for Counterterrorism, who talked about the different ways that various terrorist organizations use the internet.
So for instance, Al-Qaeda and the Islamic States, they really, they have sort of their official media outlets that they get their content out through, which is very organized, which has the same branding. They really hold that sort of, that. Well, they distribute propaganda first, and then it gets picked up by like supporter outlets or individuals, networks, etc. On the far right, it's a bit more diffuse. The far right, I would say, has less sort of organizational push on propaganda. So it's a lot of lone actor materials as well. And I would say especially lone actor attackers like the Christchurch attacker, who live streamed his attack and wrote a manifesto that really kicked off sort of all these copycat attacks afterwards, such as the Buffalo shooting. And then you can see what actually the role of manifestos and especially live streams are incredibly important for that recruitment and radicalization aspect.
In West Africa, the technological landscape is a bit different, meaning that the tech wielded by violent extremists is different as well. According to an Alliance for Affordable Internet report, only 12% of Nigerians are estimated to have meaningful internet connectivity. This connectivity, measured by factors like 4G speeds, smartphone ownership, and regular access, drops even lower in rural areas, where just 6.6% of the population have meaningful internet connectivity, underscoring how dire the situation is. This lack of widespread internet access means that West Africans are not using the internet in the same ways that other populations do, and violent extremists might be relying on older, more widely available technologies. Dr. Abubakar Kawu Monguno, a professor at the University of Maiduguri in Nigeria's northeast Borno state, told me about the most prevalent platforms used by Nigerians.
Nigerians heavily use WhatsApp as a platform to communicate. I think the other more popular is the Facebook. Instagram, yes, Twitter or X, yes, but these are more elitist. The average people, the average person in Nigeria, whether they have been to school or not, that owns an Android phone, you see him on WhatsApp or on Facebook.
Anna echoed the popularity of platforms like WhatsApp and Facebook in the Sahel. This widespread use of closed messaging platforms, however, poses a challenge for researchers like herself. It's difficult to actually monitor this content spread in these channels, as you have to be invited in. As such, closed WhatsApp and Facebook messenger groups have become a digital blind spot. Researchers are ethically bound to not deceive anyone about their identities, making it almost impossible to infiltrate these spaces organically. There is a crucial gap in our understanding of how extremist groups operate within them.
There's a bit of an access issue in terms of Boko Haram, for instance. They put a lot of their material out on closed WhatsApp groups, and you need to have access to those spaces. And usually researchers or institutions, usually when doing open source intelligence, really best practice is that you do not deceive anyone about who you are, that you do not join closed spaces where you would have to, for example, convince someone of your ideology to get access to those spaces, because that's not ethical to do so. So there is a bit of a blind spot in that sense as well, in terms of, you know, we don't have access to those closed groups.
Researchers are hitting a wall when it comes to studying extremist narratives, as these groups are taking their propaganda into closed social media platforms. But what exactly are they spewing in these digital echo chambers? Abubakar was able to provide some clarity. The focus, it seems, is on exploiting existing societal tensions, especially between Muslims and Christians, who have had animosity towards each other for years in West Africa. By manipulating information and stoking the flames of religious difference, these groups aim to pit communities against each other. Extremists bombard chats with inflammatory messages, painting entire groups as malicious villains. This calculated manipulation of social media is a recipe for violence, preying on historical divisions and inciting retaliation for made-up injustices.
Yes, the disinformation that I suspect is coming from violent extremist organizations are those messages or campaigns that try to pitch one community against another, especially the key message in here with respect to Borno and Nigeria is trying to pitch interfaith groups, you know, Muslims versus Christians especially. And so because of the occurrences, because of the cracks that have existed for a long time between these two faiths, extremists have tried, even in the past, to make these two existing faiths fight one another, and this is what they seem to carry out now. And so, what we see is that sometimes you see WhatsApp messages or even messages on Facebook that try to bring people into violence, you know, from one saying that some groups of people are killed in these people and these are the people that have killed them. And so there is need to take action. There is need to retaliate and all sorts of, you know, very violent campaign messages.
Abu Bakar's account described how terrorist organizations weaponize disinformation to incite violence, especially between different religious groups. This isn't a new phenomenon. ISIS employed similar tactics during its peak about 10 years ago. This served as a wake-up call for bigger platforms such as Facebook, Meta, to begin investing in content moderation actions as a way to curb terrorist use of their platforms. They've put in place automated measures to pick up and remove extremist posts. But, as Anna explained, this strategy isn't working exactly as planned, and violent extremist groups have still stayed one step ahead of this censorship.
I would say that during ISIS, their peak, so around 2014, 15, 16, you know, we saw almost a live tweeting of the jihad and of the life there. And I think this was a real turning point where bigger platforms realized this was sort of a tidal wave of terrorist content on their platforms. And so they started to, you know, start investing in content moderation. And so then we moderate, or the bigger platforms, they moderated these. And then we saw a shift, because obviously terrorists didn't stop using the internet because of that. They just migrated elsewhere.
Extremist groups adapted their use of technology to get around detection methods, including pivoting to lesser-known platforms. As Anna explained to me, for some enforcement agencies or researchers, that's the goal: moving extremist content to smaller, more diffuse platforms where you need specialized knowledge to find it makes it harder to reach mainstream audiences. However, extremists continue to devise ways to avoid detection from the tech giants as well. They use clever tricks like replacing letters with numbers or adding emojis to bypass automated detection. The result? A vast amount of extremist content is slipping through the cracks and remaining on easily accessible mainstream platforms, potentially radicalizing new vulnerable minds. Terrorists also wield a secret weapon in their arsenal of tricks, translating their material to other languages that automated tools can't yet pick up. This strategy is especially effective in West Africa, where hundreds of local languages and dialects are used. Messages can spread quickly and easily, as extremists don't need to worry about censorship. Moreover, the advent of widespread AI has made it easier than ever to translate messages and avoid detection.
On the one hand, you've got terrorists and violent extremists who are becoming smarter and learning about how to sort of avoid content moderation. On the other hand, you've got the bigger platforms that might be very good at moderating English spoken content or Arabic, because they massively started investing in Arabic at the peak of ISIS. But now we're actually seeing, for instance, the Sahel and like terrorist organizations there, and the content that we're seeing there gets put out in so many different languages. And what we really see is that content moderation, especially on bigger platforms, is just less good at picking at detecting that content. And so this is a real blind spot, which has been like going on for a very long time, I do have to say. And so it's an interesting thing in terms of how we're going to counter this. And I would also say that AI really complicates this, because what we have seen is that terrorist organizations are using AI, for example, to translate their messages. And so, this is obviously a worrisome sort of development, because those translations might not get picked up. But on the other side, in terms of terrorists and violent extremists and how they are avoiding content moderation, they're often called content moderation avoidance techniques, bit of a mouthful. But this could be anything from, for example, using linguistic markers. So if you want to spell a certain word, you might change one letter for a number. And so you're signaling to your in crowd, or everyone sort of who reads it will still understand it, but it won't get picked up by automated measures. Another one would be that you slightly change the content, because one of the biggest countermeasures that we have now in sort of countering terrorist content on the internet is hashing, and that's kind of a digital sort of fingerprint. And if content is slightly different, then the hash would have to be different. And so that basically makes it harder to keep up with the content. So, for example, if you think about the Global Internet Forum to Counter Terrorism, they run a hash sharing consortium. And so tech companies can basically, they have these hashes, but they can have like thousands of hashes of the same content because it might be tweets like slightly different. An example could be that you put flowers over guns, for instance, just flower emojis, and that will not get picked up by these automated measures. And so this is really an issue there.
While tech companies have found some success in combating far-right extremism on their websites through effectively pushing this content to smaller, harder-to-find platforms, their censorship measures in West Africa continue to fall short. In West Africa, the variety of local languages and use of closed messaging groups to spread propaganda make content difficult to curb. This regional disparity highlights the need for a nuanced approach that considers the global landscape of online extremism and the limitations of a one-size-fits-all strategy.
In terms of West Africa, or in terms of the Sahel as well, the thing I would say is that it's not as new, I would say, but it's kind of different than what we have here in the West in terms of, as I mentioned, like these bigger tech companies, they've moderated their platforms quite successfully, which has led to like massive amounts of content on these smaller platforms. I would say in sub-Saharan Africa or in the Sahel, like this is actually quite different, or in Africa as a continent, I would say it's quite different because a lot of the content is still on the bigger social media platforms. And that's for the reasons that we discussed in terms of like the languages being difficult to pick up. But also when you think of sort of the social media landscape there, it is actually these bigger platforms that are used predominantly. And the diversity and sort of the platforms that you use there is smaller. It is these bigger platforms still. And with internet penetration growing and social media penetration growing and offline violence getting worse in the region, you know, you can see this kind of worsening. So I would almost say it's not really, you know, emerging tech as such. It's actually just still the old problem that we had with these bigger companies still being used to a great extent.
Moreover, while AI is indeed being used by extremists to create and disseminate propaganda, it's still in its early experimental stages. As with any powerful tool, AI requires careful handling. Anna warned that openly discussing how to best leverage AI in counter-terrorism measures could inadvertently provide a roadmap for extremist groups, training them in effective use of the technology. We need to be strategic in our approach, capitalizing on AI's potential as a safeguarding mechanism while remaining vigilant against its misuse by bad actors.
There's a massive sort of focus on terrorists and extremists' use of AI. I would say that, yes, they're using it, but it is at an experimental level at the moment. That doesn't mean that it's not problematic. Obviously, we've seen, we've seen kind of Al-Qaeda, for instance, using like fully synthetic material. So kind of creating it using AI. What you could also see, though, is sort of material that is more of like an inspiring nature. So, for example, really, kind of more content that might not be like especially terrorist, but more like borderline content or disinformation. So this is an issue. And more research is coming out on this. The one thing I would say, though, is that because it's still at an experimental level, we need to make sure that we don't actually inform terrorists and violent extremists on how to use AI, because some great papers have come out recently in terms of, for example, how to jailbreak platforms. So, for example, if I said, give me all the ISIS magazines from the last 2 years, ChatGPT should tell me, well, I'm not going to do that because it goes against my terms of service, or it will say, no, I won't do that. But if you give a particular prompt that kind of deceives these platforms, there is a way to still be able to get material that might be useful for recruitment, for attack planning, for learning particular tactics. And so this has the potential to obviously get worse, but I think we need to make sure that we don't actually do research that explains to terrorists like how we use it, because there's such a massive drive on it at the moment, that I think the ethics of it really need to be kept in mind as well.
Anna has relayed both a fascinating perspective and issued urgent words of caution on the use of AI by extremists. It seems they're still in the early stages of experimentation, but the potential dangers are clear. Abu Bakar highlighted another likely hazard in the rapidly evolving world of AI: pushing extremist ideology that exploits existing societal tensions. For instance, AI could be used to manipulate footage, stoking the flames of religious discord. This chilling manipulation of reality could have devastating consequences, inciting violence between communities that have historically coexisted peacefully.
Yes, there is the use of AI. You see some kinds of packaging or framing of some ideas around how violence has been used, you know, against Muslims, and therefore there is need for retaliation. And if you look, the voicing is purely AI that is used. So you see one particular AI message with the same voice that is computer, you know, generated and voiced over some scenes, you know, that have happened in distant locations, sometimes bringing them and trying to, you know, fuel violence between the two groups that in many instances have even existed very peacefully.
We've just delved into how cutting-edge technologies are reshaping the landscape of violent extremism. Advancements like AI create new avenues for radicalization and recruitment, with extremists crafting manipulative propaganda and exploiting the vast, unregulated corners of the internet. But amidst the dazzle of the future, it's easy to overlook a more familiar tool, the mobile phone. As Abu Bakar explained, satellite networks enable terrorists to operate incognito, evading detection and continuing their activities under the digital radar. Satellite phones present a crucial advantage, especially in West Africa, where the rural regions harboring violent extremist groups often lack basic cell service.
What I see happening is actually the use of the mobile phone device, especially in the areas of satellite technology. The state is poorly covered in terms of network connection, GSM connection. Most of the rural areas, especially in the north, are poorly covered. But the insurgents have sophisticated satellite phones, used satellite connection to carry out their activities. So that is the use of technology. The use of technology, advanced technology if you want, or even an expensive technology, because it's beyond what the ordinary, the average person in the state can afford. For you to use the satellite telephone, you need a special device for you to do that, which is very, very expensive. You need to subscribe at a very, very heavy cost, which is beyond the average person living in the state. So this is what, in my own opinion, how the insurgents have been able to drive their insurgency operations.
Unlike traditional mobile phones that rely on a centralized network controlled by a specific carrier, satellite phone calls and messages are much harder to intercept and monitor. This cloak of invisibility makes them a tempting option for extremist groups who want to communicate discreetly, and makes it difficult for security forces to interrupt potential threats and track terrorist activities. As Abu Bakar explained, Nigeria requires phone users to register their SIM cards and link them with a specific digital ID, which can contain a citizen's biometric data. Allegedly, millions of phone lines are said to have been blocked following the deadline to link accounts. Those who don't have SIM cards linked to a digital ID are automatically considered suspicious by security forces.
If you use the ordinary Nigerian SIM card, you have to register with the government agencies responsible for that, even though there are challenges associated with that. So if you have the satellite phone, you are not obliged to actually register with the your SIM card at the moment with the national authorities who track, you know, the communication in and out of that phone. So that is the advantage the insurgents have, and using that they cause havoc on the communities where they operate. And that is why it's criminal at the moment for anyone to use the satellite phone within the state.
Within the Borno state?
Yes, within Borno state. It's a signal that you are likely to do some dangerous, you know, things with the phone. And so anyone caught with a satellite phone is primarily a suspect.
Despite these seemingly aggressive measures to track and intercept extremist messaging, these laws don't seem to be working. Authorities are struggling to effectively implement and enforce these measures, and critics have pointed to potential concerns about privacy. While efforts to curb online extremism through content moderation and registering SIM cards are understandable and often necessary, they can lead to a slippery slope. Censorship and surveillance, even with the best intentions, raises critical questions about the freedom of expression and privacy. Where do we draw the line between harmful content and legitimate dissent? Can effective moderation be achieved without stifling open dialogue? To what extent can we surveil our communities without infringing upon citizens' fundamental right to privacy? These are complex issues with no easy answers, and the challenge lies in finding a balance that protects public safety while upholding human rights and ensuring the censorship process is transparent. Anna weighed in on the importance of these considerations, highlighting the potential dangers of overregulation and the need for fostering open dialogue between governments, tech companies, and civil society.
I'm really of the opinion that speech norms, online or offline, they should be set by public authorities, not by private institutions such as tech companies. So what we need to do is to ground ourselves at least, well, in sort of the more extreme ones, in the rule of law. And so it's a very welcome thing from governments such as the European Union in terms of, you know, the Terrorist Content Online Regulation or the Digital Services Act, somewhere towards disinformation and other online harms, that they set the speech norms as to what is acceptable speech online and what is not acceptable speech. Because previously what we've seen is that, you know, tech companies started moderating material. And this was before there was even any regulation. And now we can see, like, you know, there's hundreds of laws now aiming to regulate the online space, which is obviously a welcome change. So I would say really the rule of law there is, yeah, is very important. And this, and governments can actually also set sort of the best practice for tech companies, right? Which would be, obviously uphold the law that you fall in the jurisdiction that you're in. But also in terms of service, like platforms can obviously, they have their terms of service, which is kind of the rules of the platform in terms of what they consider terrorism to be, what they consider hate speech to be, what is allowed on the platform and what is not allowed on the platform. And very importantly, when enforced, so when that leads to content removal or other ways of moderating, it's very important that this is being sort of published in a transparency report so that it's open. But also when content does get removed, for instance, to have appeal mechanisms. So the Terrorist Content Online Regulation actually highlights this. You need to have transparency reports and you need to have an appeal mechanism. And basically what an appeal mechanism is that if I were to say something and it would get removed and I said, well, actually, this isn't terrorist content, then it can get reinstated. And in a transparency report, it will say this level of material was actually reinstated. And so this is really a way in terms of being transparent, but also to make sure that civil society organizations and academics and other researchers can really, question tech companies like enforcement of rules, how that's done, and do so in a way that really tries to mitigate against the risk to human rights and freedom of expression. But you're absolutely right in saying, content that we call borderline content or lawful but awful, so material that is not really illegal, nor is very much violating terms of service, but that does actually have the potential for harm. And this is really the thing that we're facing now in terms of how are we going to moderate that? Because the question really is, do we need to write laws for this? It might be one of these things that actually, over-regulating it doesn't help either. But then if you don't, then that means that tech companies are basically doing this. And so this is really where it gets extremely complicated. And also, we have to think about, the freedom of expression and human rights on the one hand, but also sometimes removal or content moderation, it might not help. It might make things worse as well. And so removing, for example, a conspiracy theorist, their output, it might make them think, well, actually, I'm being censored. And it might really make someone radicalize even further.
Anna brought up a compelling point. In the fight against online extremism, clear rules of the road are essential. Governments establishing regulations like the Terrorist Content Online Regulation provide a much-needed framework for tech companies to moderate content. This ensures a level playing field and prevents platforms from becoming a lawless online Wild West. But here's the problem. Striking the right balance is paramount. Transparency reports and robust appeal mechanisms safeguard against censorship and ensure legitimate voices aren't silenced. The real challenge lies in that murky territory, the lawful but awful content that may not be illegal but can plant the seeds of radicalization. Moreover, technology is not a neutral mediator, but rather a reflection of the data used to train it. If this training material is riddled with human biases, from racial prejudice to gender stereotypes, the algorithms that power our tech will inevitably inherit these same flaws. This can have serious consequences, from perpetuating discrimination in job searches to filtering out important news stories from marginalized communities. As we move forward in a tech-driven world, acknowledging and mitigating these biases is crucial to ensuring equitable access to information and opportunity.
I sat on a panel 2 weeks ago where someone said, well, technology is neutral. And to be honest, it blew me away and negatively. It shook me because obviously it is not neutral. The training data is really crucial to this because obviously the outputs rely on this training data. And so what you can see is that these or that AI, it's already biased, both in sense of, for example, gender or ethnicities. And, there historically, obviously, we've seen, profiling, for instance, and sort of law enforcement using that and getting it the legitimate criticism, obviously, towards that, we need to make sure that AI doesn't basically make that 10 times worse. And I think that is something we really, really need to focus more attention on, and really want to drive the point home in terms of, like, technology is not neutral. And if we start using it for countermeasures, then obviously we need to make sure that we are aware of those biases. And I think another recent example where someone actually tried to create terrorist propaganda utilizing AI, and it worked. And basically, I believe when they put in a different word for terrorists, because the AI did block the word for terrorists, you immediately got Muslim men. And so obviously this leads to, like, it is biased, and we need to make sure that we are aware of this when we start utilizing it for countermeasures.
Anna's point resonates deeply. Technology is a reflection of the programs and data that train it. Since humans are inherently biased, the algorithms we create inherit those same biases. So how do we combat online extremism in a responsible way, ensuring safety without silencing legitimate voices? Building on Anna's point about human bias reflected in technology, Abu Bakar expands the conversation, arguing that this isn't just a fight for tech companies and governments. It's a battle for everyone. This global threat demands a global response. Everyone, from religious organizations to ordinary citizens, have a role to play. Whether it's promoting media literacy or flagging suspicious content, we all have a stake in creating a safer digital environment.
We are all in it because the effect is on everybody. I agree if you say the government should take the lead. I absolutely agree on that. But it's something that affects everybody. It affects government. It affects me. It affects me. It affects my neighbor. It affects my child. You know, it affects religious organizations, whether Christian or Muslim. It affects the farmer, the trader, everybody. So it's something that is consuming us, and we need to fight it back.
The fight against online extremism in West Africa, and indeed across the globe, is a complex one. Malicious extremist propaganda can infiltrate any corner of the internet, from the sophisticated social media platforms to the more localized, closed messaging groups. So how do we, as individuals and communities, take a stand? The answer lies in collective action. Religious organizations can play a crucial role in promoting peace and tolerance within their congregations. Parents can educate their children on media literacy, fostering critical thinking skills to navigate the online world. Everyday citizens can flag suspicious content and report extremist activity to the appropriate authorities. Moreover, fostering the building of media literacy skills that empower citizens to discern fact from fiction and think critically about information presented to them is crucial to countering extremist narratives. By adopting a multifaceted approach that addresses both the content itself and the underlying factors that fuel extremism, we can create a more resilient online environment for everyone. By working together, we can create a digital landscape that is less susceptible to the manipulation and radicalization tactics of extremist groups. This fight won't be easy, and there's no single solution. But by harnessing the collective power of individuals, communities, and institutions, we can begin to push back against the tide of online extremism. We can work towards a safer digital space for everyone, one where technology empowers connection and understanding rather than division and hate. Anna and Abu Bakar thank you so much for joining me. Your insight has shed light on a troubling emerging threat in West Africa and provided a path to combat violent extremism online. To our listeners, thank you for listening to Season 4 of Media Minded, the show guiding you through the age of disinformation. This podcast is produced by Shoutout UK. Make sure to follow Shoutout UK on X and Instagram to get updates on all our upcoming episodes. And don't forget to subscribe to the Media Minded podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast fix. This podcast is made possible by the generous support and sponsorship of the US State Department. Thank you for listening, and remember, stay informed.